Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm John Hodge, joined by JC the Cheese Abbott. JC, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. No complaints. It was an interesting week of CFL action. We had all this discussion about how to make our game more exciting, and then there was a couple duds out there, Hodge, to be entirely frank with you. So maybe we needed to have that discussion. I don't know.
Maybe we did, and we're going to get into it today. Don't you worry. But first, I got a brand new crisp white tee on for our audio-only listeners. You can check out the YouTube if you want to see the upper, I don't know, 30% of my beautiful crisp white t-shirt. And my question, the reason I mention it, is I'd like to hear from our listeners and our viewers. I'm going to ask JC in a moment. How many times can you wear a crisp white tee before it inevitably is no longer crisp or white? Because to me, it's like 2.5. Like, that's probably the over-under. Because every time I get a brand new crisp white tee, I'm like, oh, why do I never wear crisp white tees? These are so awesome. And then inevitably, it's coffee, it's marinara, it's something that thwarts my beautiful crisp white tee. So I'm drinking my coffee very carefully. But JC, I'm curious for you. How many times over under can you wear a crisp white tee before it's no longer crisp and white?
When I put on a crisp white tee, a 30-minute timer starts somewhere in the world on the countdown to my inevitable disaster. I don't think I've ever made it out of a single day wearing a crisp white tee where I didn't have some sort of stain that remained there permanently for the rest of time emerge. And most of the time, I don't even recognize that it happens. I just look down at myself at some point, and there it is.
There it is. Yeah, it's tough. It really is. It's tough. And again, please tag us on socials. I would love to hear. If you're somebody who can go 6 months to a year wearing the same crisp white tee without it becoming not crisp or not white, I mean, hit me up. Teach me your secrets. I will be your student. You could be my Mr. Miyagi. Please, I need to know. Because shy of wearing a transparent poncho 24/7, I don't know how anybody would do that. But I'd love to know, because I'd love to keep my crisp white tees crisp and white for longer periods of time. Today, we're discussing a major trade made in advance of the CFL's trade deadline.
Top teams in both divisions struggling during the stretch run.
BC's plan to play games during the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Potential international interest in CFL expansion.
And a top CFL draft pick hanging out at BC Place. But first,
reactions have rolled in after the CFL's historic rule change announcement last Monday. Some notable names, including Bolivar Mitchell and Zach Kolaris, appear supportive of the moves, while others have questioned why players and coaches were not consulted in advance. Canadian QB Nathan Rourke has positioned himself as the most vocal critic, calling the changes, quote, garbage, unquote, and saying he feels a responsibility to push against what he believes is an attempt to Americanize the league. There was also some passionate outcry from diehard fans, most of whom seem pretty upset about the changes. Hodge, what did you make about the reaction?
Yeah, last week, I mean, the two of us plus Justin Dunk chopped up how we felt about our initial reaction to the changes. So I feel like we've given our personal opinions on the changes, but I got a lot of opinions about the reaction to the changes and the rollout of the changes and some of the fallout. The first one I'll say is, and I don't mean to sound like a you-know-what here, but we got to work on our media literacy. a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like the press release dropped on Sunday saying that there were significant changes to the game being made on Monday. And maybe it was just wishful thinking, but I was seeing people speculate they're going to announce a 10th team, or they're going to announce a new television deal, or they're going to, and it's like the press release says significant changes to the game, not the broadcasting of the game, not expansion of the league. It says changes to the game. So I was going into that press conference anticipating that the game would be changed, because if the CFL did not follow through with changes to the game, then that would have been the most misleading press release of all time. And I don't think that the league would have felt it prudent to release a press release and then not back up any of what it had said. The other thing is the timing. A lot of fans saying, well, why wasn't this done at Grey Cup? Why wasn't this done, whatever? To me, I thought the league handled this perfectly. September is a time where NHL preseason starts to steal some of the spotlight. Obviously, the NFL season is in full swing. The Blue Jays are actually good this year. They've just won the AL East. They're going to the playoffs. This is the perfect time for the CFL to steal some headlines, right? The CFL falls by the wayside this time of year for a lot of Canadian sports fans. And so getting mainstream news coverage, getting top coverage, I thought was really important. I also think that the consultation bit, I'm also on the league side a little bit. Like, yes, it would have been nice to have a ton of people consulted, but there's a lot of context here. One is there are people in the Board of Governors who played in this league and know football. Two, there was a 5-month listening tour that Stuart Johnston went on in order to make these changes with the help of the league governors who voted unanimously. Obviously, during those 5 months, he was having a ton of conversations about what type of changes he would like to make, other people would like to see. And a lot of these changes, like changes to the Rouge, for instance, have been talked about forever. One of the reasons why the league felt it needed to step in here and make a change is because the rules committee was tasked annually with, hey, listen, we don't like this part of the game. You're the rules committee. Please figure out an alternative. And they could not do so. And that leads to a bigger problem, which is I know hundreds, if not thousands of people personally who care a tremendous amount about the CFL. I'm talking people who cheer for these teams every week in stadiums. I'm talking people who play in the league. I'm talking about people who coach in the league. I'm talking about personnel people who work in the league. I'm talking about people who work in the league office or friends of mine in the media, right, who cover this league. Tons of people. You want to know how much they agree on? The answer is less than you'd think, right? Everybody seems to agree that, oh, I think the CFL's broken. I think the CFL needs to change. I think, and then you go, okay, how? And their answer is always different. Well, this has to stay the same. But this other thing, that's my issue. I think that, and then you talk to the next person. They go, oh, well, no, actually, that's my pet issue. It has to stay the same. But this other thing, I think, has to, right? So I think that the league could have done a giant consultation, right? A year-long thing. And then they would have gotten flack for not listening to everybody, right? Oh, you consulted me just to not listen to me? So I have a lot of sympathy for the league on this, but I also do have a lot of sympathy for the fans. I'll get into that in a moment, but JC, I'll give you a chance to rebut what I've said.
Well, I think your comments on media literacy there are well taken, because even in the rule changes that were presented, there still seems to be a great deal of confusion regarding some of the motivations or some of the things that are actually happening. Hodge, I cannot tell you how many times in the last few days I have had people come forward, knowledgeable people, and say, I can't believe they're changing the last 3 minutes of the game. It's going to be a disaster, right? Well, that's not actually what's happening, right? The play clock is changing. It's going from a 20-second clock starting on the whistle of the referees to a 35-second running clock. Could there be slight influences in the final 3 minutes? Yes, but the game clock is still going to run in the same fashion in the final 3 minutes. There have been no proposed changes, no instituted changes to that part of the rule, and yet people still seem to think that that will be dramatically affected. There may be tweaks here or there. I think everyone acknowledges that, but if you sat down this weekend for some of these games and, like I did, took out a stopwatch for those final 3 minutes, you'll find that It takes the referees roughly 15 seconds to spot the ball every single time. So if that continues, this rule change will do nothing to the final 3 minutes. And I think it's that sort of catastrophic thinking that has to be interrogated a little bit. I've always been somebody who is extremely uncomfortable with change. And I must say, you know, thinking about these rule changes, sitting on it, I've become increasingly more uncomfortable with the idea of losing something like the 55-yard line, right? I think that is an iconic piece of branding that I would have liked to see stay. But there's a lot of these little tweaks and nuances that are extremely positive. And I think a lot of people have gotten their backs up here and become overly rigid on issues where I think it's okay to make a change and that it's not going to negatively affect the product in any way, shape, or form. It's not going to fundamentally change how Canadian the game is. There were some positive moves made here that I think everyone should be able to agree on, but you actually have to wrap your head around what the changes are in order to do that.
Well, and this is where I find myself a bit on the side of the fans. And for the record, I was at Ted Gavaya's funeral on Wednesday of this past week. I saw Stuart Johnston there. We had a chat. I think that the league, we didn't talk a ton about the changes. We mostly talked about Ted and obviously with it being a funeral. But obviously he said, yes, we knew people would be upset with the changes, or at least there would be a lot of hand-wringing. And I commend him for that, but I also think that maybe the league underestimated the passion for which CFL fans, right? We saw this with the Bills and MLSE thing, which, by the way, is completely separate. Like these things, a lot of fans have connected them in their brains, and I actually have a lot of sympathy for the CFL on that because they're working behind the scenes with some changes that some perceive as Americanization of the game. And then as they were in that process, they learned, oh, MLSE is planning a partnership with the Buffalo Bills, an NFL team, and that's going to get rolled out before we do our changes as a league for 26 to 27. That's not optimal, right? And those things I know for a fact are not connected, but a lot of CFL fans, given the proximity with which those things were announced, have decided that they are connected, and that's an optics issue, right, from the league perspective. Not necessarily their fault, but it's one that they have to deal with. But, I mean, to me, I've seen some pushback, people saying, well, it's not Americanization. I'm sorry, don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining. 100-yard field is Americanization. Mm-hmm. Are there still a ton of things that the CFL has that are unique? Of course, no one's saying that. But if you change anything in the CFL to be like the NFL, it is Americanization by rule. And on top of that, I've seen some people say, well, the NFL's borrowed from Canadian football before, so you wouldn't call that the Canadianization of American football. Well, that's totally different. The NFL is a juggernaut. This is a country of almost 400 million people, right? No Americans are sitting there hand-wringing going, oh, what if we lose our culture, right? Well, Canadians, we're the size of California in terms of population. Like, obviously, there's a lot of fear on the Canadian side of the border about losing culture, losing uniqueness. And that's true of almost any country in the world that is, right, a unique place with a unique culture, its own things, right? Like when I've traveled to Europe, I've learned that that is a big issue in Belgium, right? They're constantly fearful that they're going to lose their unique culture to Germany, which is right next door. The Netherlands is the same way, right? So I don't blame Canadians for hand-wringing about this. And I thought that the CFL's press conference, I wouldn't say it was a disaster. I think that would be grossly unfair. But I thought they could have communicated better, right? The last 3 minutes being a perfect example, I thought Stuart Johnston could have been a better champion saying, listen, we've got the best final 3 minutes in sports. The last 3 minutes of a CFL game are the most exciting thing that you'll see in anywhere, whether it's hockey, basketball, any other sport. We're going to, if anything, make it even better, right? And I didn't think that he did enough to kind of caution fans like, hey, I know that this is scary, but this is why we're doing the change, and this is what it's going to look like, right? Because you only get one chance to speak to everybody. And I thought in subsequent interviews, he did a good one on Edmonton Sports Talk, for instance. Stuart Johnston did a better job of tampering or tempering fears about Americanization of the game, right? Tempering fears about, we have absolutely no intentions of doing further rule changes at this point. And part of the reason he had to do that was, I think, some damage control, right? when Justin, our own Justin Dunk, asked very clearly, will the CFL ever switch to four downs? Stuart Johnston's reply should have been, as long as I'm commissioner, we're never going to four downs, right? We are not further Americanizing our game. And look, maybe 10, 20, 30, 40, I don't know, years from now, the CFL will go to four downs. But right now, what the CFL fandom needed to hear was, we are staying a three-down league. And Stuart Johnston could have said that at the press conference, which is your best and clearest opportunity to very explicitly and in no uncertain terms give your reasoning for why these changes are happening and ensure everybody or assure everybody that no other changes are going to happen. And I thought he could have done a better job of that. Maybe it was just, you know, this is his second press conference. Maybe there's some, a little bit of a learning curve there. But I certainly didn't think he did a bad job. I'm not saying that. But I thought he could have been clearer, because you only get one chance to speak to everybody. And the first press conference was an introductory press conference, right? That's a cupcake press conference. This was his first chance with scrutiny to be very clear. And again, I didn't think he did a bad job, but I think he could have done a better job being explicitly clear. Because once people, and some CFL fans have, a cursory look at social media is all you need to know to see that. Some fans have just decided, oh, this guy's a bad commissioner. Or, oh, these rule changes are garbage. And winning those people back is almost impossible. If it can happen, it's going to take years. Years! And we can argue, oh, CFL fans are sticks in the mud, or that's not reasonable, blah, blah, blah. But guess what? They're passionate fans. They're allowed to have their thoughts. They're allowed to have their feelings. And they're going to do that, which is why you need to be unbelievably clear about these types of changes. And I thought that the CFL blurred the lines a little bit at that press conference.
I completely agree with that assessment. And I know Stuart Johnston is trying not to paint himself into a corner, because he works at the pleasure of the Board of Governors, right? And he doesn't necessarily know what could come down the pipe in the future. He doesn't want to make himself look like a liar. If there are dramatic changes 10 years from now in the latter half of his commissionership or whatever it might be. But if that happens, if the league goes to four downs, people are going to hate you anyway. So why not reassure them now, right? There is absolutely no benefit to sitting on the fence currently. All it did was make fans antsy, turn them against you, create division within the fan base. It was an overall net negative. And I think Mr. Johnston has recognized that, because he has changed his tune in basically every public appearance since, on the radio or in print, saying that those rule changes are not on the table, not being considered, and won't happen. Well, if he had said that at the press conference, I think we would be having a much different narrative around this conversation. But you mentioned something there, Hodge, in terms of fans having a right to voice their opinion. I think there's somebody else we need to talk about having the right to voice their opinion, because Nathan Rourke made himself the second biggest story of the week when he essentially became the mouthpiece for those angered fans and took on the commissioner head on with some rather harsh comments in light of those rule changes, calling them garbage and, you know, accusing the commissioner of not knowing ball essentially and being in favor of being more like the NFL. And I've seen a lot of people side with Nathan Rourke who didn't like the rule changes, and I've seen a lot of criticism of Nathan Rourke. And while I don't necessarily align with everything he believes about the rules, I'm somewhere in the middle, I will say that I was very pleased to see Rourke take on this mantle and use his voice in the manner that he is. And I think a great degree of the criticism against him is utter nonsense, right? I've heard from fans who were upset and felt slighted that Nathan went to chase $1 million in the NFL, say, well, now he's not allowed to care about our game and our league, a league he grew up watching and a game he grew up playing. You can't have it both ways. Either it matters to him or it doesn't, right? I've also had people who were moaning last year about how he wasn't doing enough media or he wasn't good enough to TSN. He wasn't willing to talk. He's not taking on the mantle of the face of the league or the highest paid player of the league. That's part of his job. Now complain because they don't like what he's saying when he clearly understands the platform that he has, the power that he has, and he feels a responsibility to use it. You don't get to control how the guy uses that platform. If he feels passionately about this, then it is his right, and I would say his duty, to speak out. He has a unique power amongst the players, and even if you don't agree with him, having Nathan Rourke in this capacity, I think, is a perfect salve to any of the burns that the league or Stuart Johnston has delivered to the fan base. Because now you have some people who felt like they were unrepresented, who felt like they didn't have a voice, who felt like something is being ripped away from them. And now the biggest star in the league, the most marketable star, has said publicly and vehemently and aggressively that he is on their side, that he feels their pain, that he's going to fight for them. And even if it results in nothing and the changes all go through, which I suspect is what's going to happen, that is going to create a loyalty and a dedication from those aggrieved fans where they're not going to turn off the TV like they've threatened to. They're going to say, I'm going to keep watching for that guy because he stood up for me and he said the things I was thinking. And that is always, always, always a positive.
Yeah, I like what Nathan Rourke said. I don't agree with all of it, but I liked what he said. And at the end of the day, the CFL, like when you consider expanded practice rosters, injured players, all those things, there's like 700 players in this league, right? And there's like 694 of them who are terrified of getting cut and five more who are like a little antsy about getting cut, right? Nathan Rourke is basically the only guy who's like, yeah, what are you going to do? Fire me? I'm the best player in this league. I'm saying that, not Nathan. I'm the best player in this league. I'm Canadian. I play the most important position. I got a fat contract. Like, there's eight other teams who'd have me tomorrow, right? Like, this guy could say something truly heinous, and I'm talking not about football. He could say something horrible about fill in the blank, and he'd still have a job. Why? Because he is the best player, and he's got a Canadian passport, and he's just entering his prime as a player, right? So Nathan Rourke, I love that he said what he said, and I think that this falls in line, right, with what Stuart Johnston has made clear, I think wisely as somebody with a media background, which is we need to be comfortable with people saying things that are critical, right? Obviously, this has come to a head this year with Luke Wilson of TSN being critical of the league and Stuart Johnston saying, yeah, that's fine, right? It's rare for a rights holder to allow somebody to be critical of the league. Well, this is what's happened this year. And I think we at Three Down Nation can say, when you write an article that's titled Nice Guy Likes Playing Football, which is an article that gets written every year during training camp about 50 times by other outlets around the league, it's like, yeah, this is not growing the game. Nice Guy Likes Playing Football is not a story. Not every story has to be over-the-top, bombastic, ridiculousness, critical, whatever. But I think having a nice balance of, hey, we're going to tell it like it is when it's good. We're going to tell it like it is when it's bad. And everybody's allowed to be critical of what they feel as long as they, you know, you put your name behind it and you say it with your full chest and you accept the consequences. That's exactly what Nathan Rourke did. And I agree with it. I certainly love that he did that. Again, I don't agree with every single thing that he said, but I think a lot of CFL fans, as you, I think, very eloquently said, JC, felt heard by Nathan Rourke, felt validated, and they were pleased that somebody was standing up. I also like what Zach Kolaris said, what Nick Arbuckle said, right, what Bo Levi Mitchell said, where they're saying, hey, totally get where the kid is coming from. Obviously, he's Canadian, but also there's lots of other things here, right? And there have been people, lots of players who have publicly said, yes, they like the changes, or no, I don't like the changes. Coaches have said, yes, I like the changes, no, I don't like the changes. I love when on CJOB 680 on his coach's show, Mike O'Shea said, yeah, what Nathan Rourke said was fantastic, right? Like Mike O'Shea himself, I don't think is a fan of change period. I don't think that he likes the Canadian Football League messing with its rules. And it was funny to hear him propping up Nathan Rourke, considering that Nathan Rourke might be the reason the Bombers don't go back to another six straight Grey Cup this year. Obviously, that remains to be seen. We'll talk about that in a bit. But I think the more conversation, the better. And that is, I'll give full credit to Stuart Johnston. I think that is something he 100% understands, is that for the league to grow, right, and the league to get better on the business side, from getting more media attention, all those things, you have to be comfortable with people not standing in a circle singing Kumbaya and holding hands, right? You have to have that controversy, because nobody talks about the NFL like, man, you know, Jordan loves, like he loves playing football. Oh, and you know who else loves playing football? It's that Shedeur Sanders. He loves playing football. It's like, no, the people you talk about are the controversial figures. And in a league of, like, what, 3,000 players in the NFL, how many really get talked about? The answer is like 12. There's like 12 players who can generate headlines, and they generate headlines because they're controversial, right? They say things that some people really admire and some people really hate, and there's divisiveness and there's diversion. And I don't think the CFL ever wants to, or at least I'll speak for myself, I don't want the CFL to ever be a place that, you know, the game is secondary and people are just talking about drama. But if we could live in a world where there's a little more drama, right, a little more division, a little more debate, right, in CFL circles, that's a good thing. We've seen it happen this year with, you know, the CJ Rivas hit on Zach Collaros. We've seen some parts of that this year. There's still controversy every year when it comes to calls, non-calls, or close games, whatever. I think this is a good conversation for the CFL. And again, I think they could have done a better job of being clear at the press conference. But in terms of the changes themselves, I don't like all of them, but I understand all of them. I'm fine with most of them. And I think at the end of the day, this has been a win for the CFL because of the conversation it's generated, the headlines it's generated. Full disclosure, so I was at the funeral in Burlington last week, and I saw my mother-in-law, who lives in Toronto, the next day. My mother-in-law is in her 70s. She doesn't know a single CFL team or player. She doesn't care about football. The first thing she asked me when I saw her was, what do you think about these changes to the CFL? And it was like, whoa, I've known this woman for 15 years and she has never asked me a question about the Canadian Football League. So this is good firsthand evidence. It's a small sample size, but it's good firsthand evidence that people who do not think about the Canadian Football League on a day-to-day basis, don't watch the league, have never been to a game, any of those things, are suddenly talking about this league in the fall, when again, it struggles for relevancy before the playoffs. I think once the playoffs hit, this league is, you know, it's at the top for a lot of Canadian sports fans, but weeks like 15, right, once Labor Day is done, to week 21, this league really struggles, I think, to find its footing, and it found a way to do that this week in a good way, and I think that it's positive that people are talking about it, including Nathan Rourke, who, again, I thought did a nice job as one of very few players in this league with security, standing on business and speaking with his whole chest.
I will say one last thing because I know we have to move on. I think there is still a test coming for Stuart Johnston's theory that it's okay to be criticized. And that is whether or not Nathan Rourke gets fined for these comments. Typically, those fines take place a full week after an event has happened, even though they issued fines for last week on Friday. I suspect we wouldn't get anything for actions on Monday until this coming week. If they come out and fine Nathan Rourke for bringing the league in disrepute, as they have with previous players that have spoken out against the commissioner under Randy Ambrosi's tenure, then I think you're just inviting more of a firestorm, right? If they don't fine Nathan Rourke, I think that is a signal from the commissioner that he is going to be open to having these types of discussions. And I think you can make an argument to either side, whether you should fine or whether you should not. But it's going to be very telling what decision the league makes on that particular topic. And that will determine whether Johnston really believes what he's saying about criticism.
That is an excellent point. And obviously, I think in terms of, at least I'll just speak from my recollection, I believe the only person to be fined so far this year is CJ Rivas for speaking out or being critical or the social media policy after he was fined for criticizing the call against him in that, or at least he was critical of being fined for the hit he laid on Zach Collaros, and that, of course, got a subsequent fine for being critical. So I agree. It's a great point. We'll have to wait and see. There's been no fine thus far that I'm aware of. But yes, obviously on the CFL side of it, you don't want players being able to call the league or decisions that the league makes garbage every week and not fine them. But I agree, optically, it would be bad to fine Nathan Rourke for saying what he said. So it's an excellent point. Last thing I'll say about this is I'm really curious to see what the CFL looks like, sounds like, at Grey Cup week. Stuart Johnston has moved the commissioner's address back to Friday. It used to be under Randy Ambrosi Tuesday morning at an ungodly hour, I think because he was frankly worried about what some members of the media would ask and some of the scrutiny that he would face. Well, Stuart Johnston has moved it back to Friday. So we're still almost two full months away from what will likely be the next press conference Stuart Johnston does. Will there be more changes? He certainly said there are going to be more changes. Now, he has been clear that these changes will not be to the rules themselves, but for example, things like realignment. Are we going to just have a 9-team CFL with no divisions in 2026? Are we going to have awards that are not by division in 2026? These are changes that I'm personally in favor of, and I think they are low-hanging fruit, right? It's things that, yes, are change, and I'm sure there will still be people upset, and they're entitled to feeling upset if they're upset about it, but these are changes that have nothing to do with the on-field product and the game itself. And by the way, the reason why I am a big proponent of a one division CFL is because I think that the playoff race would be much more exciting. I've said that previously. We're going to get into it. So I'll list them out right now. Saskatchewan 10-4, Hamilton 9-6. These are two teams that are pretty comfortably in the driver's seat of their own division. Well, if there was only one bye week up for grabs, that would be a much more intense race. As it is, the Saskatchewan Roughriders and Hamilton Tiger Cats do not compete come playoff time unless they meet in the Grey Cup, and their records are completely irrelevant to one another because of the rules. Maybe 2026 that will be different. And then of course you've got Calgary, Winnipeg, BC, and Montreal all at 8 wins right now. If regardless of division, right, there were 2 or 3 home playoff games up for grabs, I think that would be a much more exciting race. As of right now, it's kind of exciting in the West. But out East, it's pretty much guaranteed Montreal is going to get a home playoff game. It's not mathematically guaranteed yet, but for all intents and purposes, it is. So I'm curious to see if any more changes are rolled out. And I'm also really interested to hear what Stuart Johnston says about further rule changes to the game. Because if I were him, I would use Grey Cup, which is arguably the largest megaphone he's going to have all year long. I would use that to say, hey, listen, CFL fans, we've heard you. We understand you. We love you. We respect you. We are guaranteeing that for the next 5 years, there will be no rule changes to the CFL. And as long as I'm commissioner, we'll never play 3-down or we'll never play 4-down football. That's what I would say if I were Stuart Johnston. Because as you said, JC, like, I respect Stuart Johnston for having the integrity of saying, I never say never. I never want to promise anything like that. But at the same time, if you ever go to 4-downs, fans are going to hate you anyway. Why not just say it, right? I think we've all said to, especially if you're a parent, we've all said to a kid, everything's going to be okay, while simultaneously knowing in the back of your mind, I'm not sure everything is actually going to be okay, but I'm going to say this because this is what the kid needs to hear right now, and everything will probably be okay, right? So sometimes you just got to take somebody by the hand and say, everything's going to be okay. We're going to be playing 3-down football forever. And if that does change, I mean, first of all, I think the league is cutting off its own legs because fans do not want 4-down football. So yeah, why not just say that? Why not promise it to them? Doesn't make sense to me. The CFL trade deadline is Wednesday, October 1st, but the Calgary Stampeders made an early splash by acquiring former most outstanding defensive player Lorenzo Mauldin IV from the Ottawa Redblacks in exchange for a 4th-round pick in the 2026 CFL draft. What do you make of the move? And are there other changes that should follow Calgary's lead?
Well, I thought this was a fantastic move by head coach and general manager Dave Dickinson to address a clear need for this team. Since Falernes Ormalade went down with his Achilles tear, this Calgary defense hasn't been the same. They haven't had the same pass rush, which was the driving force behind their success. It's basically dried up, and they've suffered as a result, right? It's three straight losses now. They're losing their foothold. We'll get into some of the implications of that in a second, but they needed to do something drastic, and I think this was the best available move on the table. Is Lorenzo Mauldin the MODP caliber player he once was? No, I don't think he is. But I also think that his two sacks on the season and his lack of production aren't necessarily indicative of the true player he is and what he would look like in Calgary's system. I think you've got a brilliant opportunity here to take a rental on a guy who has proven production, who can step into your system very easily, who's going to provide a little bit extra pressure off the edge, who's going to free things up for Jalen Hutchins inside, free things up for Clarence Hicks on the other side, and will revitalize you for the playoff push. So I will let you speculate about what some of the other moves around the league could be. This was the one I had circled, Calgary adding a defensive end, and I don't think you could have added a better one at this stage than Mauldin.
Agreed with everything you said, JC. I think the one bad thing that maybe the signals to Red Blacks fans is, you know, it's clear that Ottawa's brass is in 2026 territory.
What? No? Their season's over?
Well, mathematically, they can finish second. They can.
Are you telling me they're not going to make the playoffs? Hutch, this is huge news.
That the math is. Well, I guess, no, that's not true. The math is telling you that it's possible. If Montreal lost all of their last games and Ottawa won all of their remaining games, Ottawa would host the East semi if Toronto didn't also win out. But obviously the possibility that or the likelihood of that is extremely low. So I think that Ottawa's brass has been smart to say, hey, listen, we're 4-10. This season has not gone the way that we wanted it to. Let's start taking some of our older assets, players, you know, Mauldin is 33, guys who are not under contract for next year, and see if we can get something back for them. And a fourth round pick, it's not a king's ransom, but at this point of the season, I think it's worth something, right? Like let's start adding mid-round picks. These mid-round picks could potentially be packaged later to move up potentially in the draft, if that's something you really want to do in a very NCAA heavy 2026 CFL draft. So I like the move for the Red Blacks. I like the move for the Stampeders. The other one to me is the Saskatchewan Roughriders need to trade for a kicker. I mean, Brett Lauther, 68.9% for his field goals, which would be great if it was 1972. The problem is it's 2025. Kickers are expected to be 85 plus, preferably 90 plus, and he's not even anywhere near that. And the Saskatchewan Roughriders, yeah, okay, they just lost to Edmonton. Trevor Harris had a terrible game. But at the end of the day, this is a team with Grey Cup caliber quarterbacking, Grey Cup caliber receiving core. The offensive line has been much better. The run game is very good. Defensively, it might be the best pass rush in the CFL, right, with the Stamps being banged up. The linebacking core is very solid. The secondary, when healthy, is very good. Obviously, they've had some injuries, but I think everyone's expected back. You know, the return game's been fine. Like there's really no holes in this team except for the kicking game, which is miserable. Now, the downside for Saskatchewan is that Lewis Ward is only a 78% kicker this year. That is also substandard. But I think if you make a move to bring in Lewis Ward from Ottawa, if you can pry Liram Hirilahu out of Toronto, like these are moves that you need to make. And you can stand pat with Brett Lauther. I mean, they've also got Campbell Fair on the roster, who's a draft pick out of the University of Ottawa. Fair enough. But if you stand pat and you lose the West Final because you do not have the right kicker, or you lose the Grey Cup because of the right kicker, fans will rake you over the coals forever. Right. Whereas if you make a move, you be proactive and you bring in Lewis Ward or you bring in Liram Hirilahu, all of a sudden it's like, okay, even if this player doesn't get us to the, you know, lead us to victory in the West Final, doesn't get us to win in the Grey Cup, at least as the club's brass, you can say, look, we tried. We did something. We have this shortcoming on our team. We tried to fix it. And obviously, if you bring in a kicker and they win you the Grey Cup, well, now you're a hero forever. This is a team that's only won 4 Grey Cups. And the last time they won the Grey Cup, here's the other thing, JC. The last time they won the Grey Cup in 2013, they went over the salary cap. Does anybody care? No. Like, nobody talks about that. They just won the Grey Cup in 2013, and everyone's talked about it for the last 12 years. Like, it's the greatest day in Saskatchewan history. The Riders winning the Grey Cup in Regina. So if you're the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, I don't care how far you are over the cap. If that's a concern, I don't know. That's me speculating. It's not inside information. But if there's any concern about going over the cap this year, you say, we don't care. We're moving Brett Lawther as a healthy scratch to the one-game injured list, and we're bringing in a kicker. Theoretically, this year, the cap should be less of a concern than any other year because the cap randomly went up after free agency was done, which is wild, but it happened. So to me, you screw the cap, you screw everything else. You just say, yes, we're bringing in a kicker. We'll trade for 10 kickers. We'll give them all a chance. Like, you do whatever you can, but you have to do something. If you sit on your hands and you keep trotting out Brett Lawther, who by all accounts has had a very good career, but is clearly having a very bad season, you have to do that. Do you not?
I would agree. I think this move should have been made a while ago, ideally before the 9-game mark when Brett Lawther's contract became guaranteed. So I think the Saskatchewan Roughriders have really painted themselves into a corner here. But yes, they need to make a change. They need to absorb whatever cost it takes in order to have reliable kicking, because right now they don't. The other move that I would circle as something that I would be looking into if I was a team, although I think it's probably a little bit fantastical that it would happen right now, is if I was the Calgary Stampeders or if I was the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, I would be kicking the tires to see if I could add a backup quarterback. Maybe somebody like a Dustin Crum. Would he be available? I don't know that Ottawa would part with him. But of course, Calgary lost PJ Walker. VA, who's been hurt a couple times this year and isn't playing very well right now, is currently backed up by Josh Love, who is completely unproven, and Logan Bonner, who threw 5 picks in his debut last year. And in Winnipeg, Chris Streveler has proven that he's not the guy, and Terry Wilson is completely unproven. So if you could add a guy who in his last few games has flashed, I think that potentially makes you a little bit more comfortable going forward into the playoff race. I just don't know if it's going to be in the cards and if those players are going to be made available at this stage.
I mean, without your number one quarterback, I think you're probably screwed anyway. But I hear what you're saying, JC. Some depth would be nice, especially in Calgary, where like they have none.
I think those two teams, right? It's not just some depth would be nice. Both of those guys have been injured multiple times this year, right? It's not just a one-off. They've got some recurring things that have been happening to them. So you need to be prepared for the insurance policy, in my mind. The Saskatchewan Roughriders currently hold first place in the West Division, but lost their second consecutive game for the first time this season on Saturday. Meanwhile, the Calgary Stampeders have lost 3 straight and have loosened their vice grip, on second place. With BC and Winnipeg surging, which of these two teams should be more concerned?
Oh, it's the Calgary Stampeders by a country mile. And the reason is they've got 8 wins. This is an 8-win football team. You know who else are 8-win football teams? The BC Lions and the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, right? The Stamps do have the season series against Winnipeg. They do not have the season series against the BC Lions. In fact, the BC Lions can clinch that season series with a win this week, which would all of a sudden put Calgary in a big hole. The Stamps do have a game in hand on Winnipeg and BC, so that should be stated. But like, this team's bread and butter was a remarkable defense, and they, for the last 3 games, have not had Jalen Hutchings and Falara Nirimalade out there. Hutchings missed the first game. Nirimalade missed the last 2 after Hutchings came back. And Nirimalade is obviously out for the season with a torn Achilles. And that defense has been completely and utterly exposed. Like, without having arguably the 2 best D linemen in the league, they are not getting pressure with 4. And not getting pressure with 4 means everybody's getting exposed on the back end. The Calgary Stampeders have lost their last 3 games by double-digit margins. Like, these aren't even close games. Like, they're getting they lost it by 18 points to a rusty Davis Alexander. And don't get me wrong, Davis Alexander is a heck of a player. But this guy's not played a football game in 2 months. He's played 1 game in the last 3 months, and he puts 38 points up on you as a number one ranked defense. Like, that to me is wild. And this speaks to something I say all the time on this show, so forgive me for beating a dead horse here. But the season starts week one. The Saskatchewan Roughriders started this season hot. They were 10-2 after once they reached the two-thirds mark of the season. And that is why they are not panicking right now. They are still 4 points ahead of Calgary for first place. They have a game in hand on Winnipeg and BC. And they've got the season series against both teams. So why, if you're the Saskatchewan Roughriders, are you panicking? There's no panic. All you're concerned about is the West Final and the Grey Cup, which is why you need a kicker who can convert at a rate that's higher than 68.9%. But to me, it's all about the Calgary Stampeders right here, potentially slipping not even just to third place in the West, JC. The Stampeders could realistically be the crossover team if they don't get this figured out.
You're spot on there, Hodge, and I think it's worth noting, when Calgary was having success earlier in the season, we talked about what Bob Sloak had done on defense and how it wasn't a overly complicated scheme. It was fairly simplistic, but that it was asking each player to do their job well, right? They had to perform, and because all the pieces were performing, it was having a massive amount of success. Well, right now, because of injuries, they don't have that. And the margin for error is gone. And we've seen that in multiple games this year where now they are struggling to keep it together on a side of the ball that was a distinct strength. Now, will the addition of Lorenzo Mauldin, as we just talked about, help that? I'm certain it will. Will the re-addition of Marquel Lee potentially help that in the linebacking core? He's been gone for most of the season with injury, and I think will be an upgrade over what, with all due respect, Adam Bighill is doing in there right now. Yes, those things will help the Stampeders, but they do not have the room to operate that Saskatchewan does right now. And more importantly, they don't have the offense right now that Saskatchewan has shown. VA, the last few weeks, has not been good, and it hasn't just been with the injury. Digging back to the Labor Day Classic against Edmonton, he has not played particularly well. He needs to turn it around, and they need to get back to the basics on defense with the new addition and sort those things out, because otherwise they are potentially going to put themselves behind the eight ball after, frankly, being my favorites to win the Grey Cup at the midway point of the season.
What's that I hear? I hear a Canadian quarterback calling in the distance. Woo! Justin Dunk has joined the show. How are you doing, Mr. Dunk?
Good to catch up with you, fellas. Thanks for having me on.
There you go. We're just talking about if Saskatchewan or Calgary should be panicking over their short losing streaks here. We're both on Calgary. What are your thoughts on where the Saskatchewan Roughriders sit right now?
I think I would agree with you on Calgary, but the Riders' last couple games have to be concerning. And I kind of want to get into this idea of teams hitting their peak, like let's say for Grey Cup. I think you want to be a consistently highly productive, high quality, high end team, however you want to slice it. And the Riders have talked about wanting to peak at the right time. I don't necessarily think you're always going to hit your peak at the Grey Cup. I just think you want to be a really good team. But there's no doubt that injuries have been a major factor in the last two Riders losses, namely in the secondary, the first one against Montreal, Marcus Sales, Tavon Campbell out, the most recent one, Tavon Campbell out. But there's no excuse for that. I thought the defense actually played fairly well in that football game. Trevor Harris can't be throwing those couple interceptions that he did. And I thought the ball was in harm's way from his standpoint far more often than we've seen this season. And then you got a guy like Keyshawn Johnson, the second drive of the game, they're in the red zone fumbling the football. Like, that game to me was there for the taking. But then you look at the back end of it, and Roland Milligan Jr. is out here busting a coverage for O.J. Hilaire to make a key reception in that game to lengthen the lead that ultimately Saskatchewan fell just short. So I hate saying this phrase, but the Riders shouldn't be hitting the panic button because they're still well ahead here. And plus, if you look at their schedule, they have, I suppose, arguably the two worst teams in the league coming up on the schedule. Ottawa, who have made it clear that their season is done by trading Lorenzo Mauldin. And then Toronto after that. Doesn't seem like Chad Kelly's walking through that door this season for the Argonauts. And that's a game that Toronto has to go out to Saskatchewan. They'll have to get used to that trip. They'll make it two times in 2026. So I think the Riders need to get right here, but that they should still be the odds-on favorite to host the West Final.
Oh, and I'll throw this out here. The Calgary Stampeders schedule, not easy. Like, they have to play at BC this week. They're going at Hamilton in week 19. The Ticats only 2 points up on the Alouettes. They're going to have something to play for in week 19. After that, it gets a little bit easier for the Stamps. They host the Toronto Argonauts, who at that point will likely be mathematically eliminated. Then they will travel to Edmonton to play the Elks, a team that, again, barring, it's not impossible, but barring a major surprise, will be mathematically eliminated by that point. So the last two games for the Stampeders, you know, I don't think are going to be a murderer's row, but these next 2 weeks are tough. And the last thing the Calgary Stampeders want to be is 8-8 heading into the last two games of the season. If that happens, there's a very real chance this could be the crossover team going to the East Division, which is unthinkable considering where this team was a month ago.
That, to me, fellas, is the major conversation in the West Division, is whether or not Winnipeg or BC can host a home playoff game. And I hope I didn't miss it, but JC, like, do you think BC can do that?
Well, they've completely transformed my view of the team over the last few weeks, because I came on this very podcast and said that I thought BC was going to be the team missing the playoffs, and they've only won since then. Nathan Rourke played remarkably in the first two games of this winning streak. I think a lot of that was on his shoulders, but I would say this win this past week was almost more impressive from an organizational standpoint, or at least more positive from an organizational standpoint, because Rourke didn't play bad, but he had three bad interceptions in that first half, in that game. It wasn't all on him. And against a team that before Labor Day had absolutely flambéed that defense, torched them to within an inch of their life, the defense came up big, right? Their pass rush is revitalized with Levi Bell and Bradley Anae stepping in there at the defensive end spots. It has allowed Matthew Betts the freedom to pin his ears back and know that the quarterback can't escape to the other side. And his sack production is up to 9 in the last 3 games alone. It's a completely different unit right now than what we saw for the first 3 quarters of the season. So if you want to talk about peaking at the right time, it looks like the Lions are doing that. And when it's no longer just on the shoulders of one man to pull off a miracle, I think you become a lot more confident that this is a team that can not only host a playoff game, but win a playoff game and potentially make a run to the Grey Cup.
The Hamilton Tiger Cats got blown out by Winnipeg on Saturday and now sit just one game above Montreal for first place. The Alouettes are in the midst of a 3-game winning streak, with their latest coming courtesy of a dazzling return from quarterback Davis Alexander. Has the balance of power in the East officially shifted away from Steeltown?
I think it has. And I think it comes down to the Montreal Alouettes getting healthy, and getting healthy at the most important position, right? This was the team that we said was definitively not just the best in the East, but the best in the CFL for the first stretch of the season. And we thought it was going to stay that way. But Davis Alexander goes down with his hamstring. They didn't get great play from their backup quarterbacks, and they got banged up in the receiving core. They got banged up on the defensive side of the ball. Now they're starting to get those players back. Mustafa Johnson, a couple weeks ago, along that defensive line, is a huge boost. Some of the receivers are back in the lineup now and have been for a few weeks. And Davis Alexander comes in this past game, and it looked like he flipped a switch. Now, they won the last two under MBT. Full credit to him for turning that around. This is now a 3-game winning streak. But Alexander made it look different. His ability to stretch the field is elite among CFL quarterbacks right now, and I think it brings an element that has been missing to the Alouettes. I don't know that they're going to be able to get the 2 games needed to leapfrog over the Hamilton Tiger Cats and actually secure first place in the East. That is going to be a challenge and a tough race, But right now, they have to be considered the favorites to come out of the East and go to the Grey Cup, because if those guys stay healthy and they keep playing like they are, they have, I think, a higher level of talent overall than Hamilton does.
It's a factor for all the teams in the Canadian Football League. If your QB1 stays healthy, then I think for the Alouettes, especially in this instance, as JC has laid out, with Davis Alexander, makes them the favorite to come out of the East. As weird as that might sound to Ticats fans who might be like, what are these guys talking about? But I think it's real. You saw how much energy Davis Alexander has when he was just on the sidelines with this football team. But him coming back on the field, like, this guy is just different, as one source put it to me, in terms of how he elevates the play of players around him. And then you saw the post-game video, or if you haven't, you should go check it out on the Alouette social media feeds. The guys are chanting for Davis Alexander and the locker room. And I know that winning arguably is the best drug out there, and that can bring people together. But the looks on their faces, knowing that this guy is back, to me, shows that they have confidence to go on and legitimately compete for a Grey Cup. Can they do that with Davis Alexander? That's a question that needs to be answered. But there is no doubt, from so many facets, they are a different football team with Davis Alexander on the field and healthy. And he said after the game that his left hamstring that he's been working to come back from was sore, but also that it was vital for him to play because he didn't want to come back, I believe it is on October 13th, and then October 18th, and play two games in 5 days after a long layoff. So it appears that Davis Alexander and the Alouettes training staff, the coaches, the front office, went about this in a smart way. He made it out relatively healthy, other than saying it was sore, and that bodes well for the Alouettes' chances down the stretch, considering there's a bye week here to get him some time to be ready for the stretch run.
First off, the best drug in the world is not winning. Soft serve ice cream is the best drug in the world. Winning is a close second, I will admit, but it's not the best. But let's look at the schedules here, because as JC laid out, the Tiger Cats have the home, or have the tiebreaker. So the Alouettes need to actually finish with more points than Hamilton in order to clinch first place. And that's tough to do because the Ticats, as stated, have Toronto this week. They then host the Stampeders. Then they have a bye in week 20. Then they host the Ottawa Redblacks in week 21, a team that by that point will almost surely be mathematically eliminated. They're already on to 2026. So if you're the Tabbies, you only need to win two of these last three to clinch first place. I like their chances of beating Toronto this week in a bounce back, kind of get right game. I like their chances of beating Calgary in week 19, and I love their chances of beating the Ottawa Redblacks in week 21. Now, the Montreal Alouettes don't have a murderer's row of opponents. They are on a bye, and then they have a home and home with the Ottawa Redblacks. Yeah, winning back to back against the same team can be a bit tough, but as stated, the Redblacks are into next year already. They then travel to Winnipeg in week 21. Yeah, the Bombers have been tough as of late with Zach Collaros back, but the Bombers might have nothing to play for that last week. So I am still on the Tabbies here to finish first place. But to me, the better question is, well, what happens come the East Final? If these two teams do meet in the East Final, which team will get the win? To me, the better-looking team, at least when at full strength, is the Montreal Alouettes. With Davis Alexander, he is the straw that stirs the drink offensively, and then defensively, they've gotten right as they've gotten healthy, as you guys, I thought, astutely laid out. So I am curious to see where the finish will be. I suspect in the regular season, it's Hamilton 1, Montreal 2. Come the playoffs, I think the Alouettes are going to be able to put a hell of a fight up at Hamilton Stadium, if in fact that is where the East Final is played. The BC Lions have announced they will play two home games next season at a temporary venue in Kelowna when the 2026 FIFA World Cup kicks them out of BC Place Stadium. Is this a smart move by the team?
It's an absolutely brilliant move by the team, and it's going to take some logistical pulling together to pull off, right? They're going to Kelowna. playing in the Apple Bowl, which is where the Okanagan Sun of the Canadian Junior Football League currently play. Right now, as it stands, that facility can host just over 2,000 people. Now, they will be expanding everything out around it because it's basically a blank slate. And with temporary stands, they're going to be able to fit at least 17,500 in. And team president Dwayne Veneau told me that the hope is with party zones and end zone standing areas and all the other bells and whistles that go with an event like that, their capacity is going to be around 20,000. And I have no doubt that with the football community in the BC interior, which is so underserved as it currently stands, they're going to sell that out, and they're going to sell that out in an instant for both games. There are some passionate people up there, some dominant high school programs, some great players have come out of that area, but they don't get to go to Lions games all that often because it's a 4+ hour drive to get into the city. And by the time that, you know, games are over, you're talking about hotel room costs and all these different things. Now these fans are going to have an opportunity to see their team. I think it's a wonderful initiative. And it should be noted, it was not intentionally done this way, but this announcement was made after the first quarter of their game against the Toronto Argonauts, who are, of course, the other team that is being kicked out of their stadium for the World Cup and have elected not to do something that would have been much easier for their own fans by taking it an hour down the road to a place like Guelph where there is an existing facility. I think you see the contrast between the two ownership styles between MLSC and Amar Doman here. Doman was going to pay whatever was necessary out of his own pocket, if he had to ensure that this game or these two games stayed in the province of British Columbia and were accessible to his fans. He has pulled that off, and I think it's going to be a wonderful couple of weeks.
Amar Doman for the win. Like, that needs to be repeated multiple times. JC, you're on point with all that analysis, although I will say Riders fans at least are like 4 hours. Like, some of these fans travel 8-10 hours one way to come to games. There's one couple that I usually see that comes from Calgary for every single home game. And I think that drives 8 hours one way. All due respect. But anyways, this is an awesome move. And I loved, as you alluded to, JC, that the announcement came when they were playing the Toronto Argonauts, because the Argos should learn a thing or two from this. The cost for Amar Doman here to put this on in Kelowna, you know, I can't really sort of ballpark it, but it's definitely much more than what it would have been for the Argonauts, let's say, as you alluded to go to the University of Guelph and play a game. And I'm not just saying Guelph because I played there, but I think it would make a lot of sense for a number of reasons to play that game in Guelph, because you're not getting too far away from Toronto. Varsity Stadium down there, where the University of Toronto Blues play, is a stadium that I think would be difficult to add additional seating to, because you have, I think, about 5,000 on this one side of the stadium. But then on the other side, there's like a, you guys have been there for the CFL Combine, a black wrought iron fence that you'd essentially have to rip out. I'm not saying you couldn't do it. Amar Doman is proving you can pretty much set up a CFL level field wherever is possible in our country. So I just think that Guelph would have made the most sense, because it's not too far for your hardcore Argos fans to come that are in the Toronto area or outside of it. But it just shows again that Amar Doman has a long-term approach, that it's not necessarily about the upfront costs here. I get that you have to swallow that at the beginning, but this is about getting potentially a bunch of fresh eyes on your product and creating news around that. And I think that's what the Argos are missing out on. MLSC could have easily afforded to put on 3 Argos games elsewhere in the GTA or somewhere creative. They chose not to. I get it's a business decision, as we've talked about on the podcast. But Amar Doman, this truly shows us he continually puts his money where his mouth is, and he understands that marketing, especially in these new areas to potential new fans, is going to really help his franchise and the CFL in the future.
When the Lions announced that they were making an announcement at the end of the first quarter of their game, I took to Twitter and joked that they were going to play the last three quarters with four downs. And I just want to apologize for being super funny. I just want to say that. I'm sorry that I'm hilarious. That joke was awesome.
Fans are so anxious about going to four downs and you're just playing on those fears, bro, for a crack. Come on.
Did anybody really think it was a serious thing? Like, I know that I am a reporter. I do take that responsibility seriously. But I'm not allowed to make jokes that are obviously jokes. Like, come on. I thought it was funny. And I hope that you, the listener, thought it was funny as well. If you didn't think it was funny, well, I don't know. Maybe put on an episode of Seinfeld. Make Justin happy.
Is it time for JC's random neglister?
It is. It's absolutely time for JC's random neglister.
Hodge, I thought you would want to dap up Amar Doman some more.
You guys already did that. I mean, everybody knows Amar Doman is awesome. Like, come on. We know this.
He's the oat. Or the goat with double O's. The greatest donger of all time.
The goot?
Goot. The goot. The goot.
Actually,
Amar Doman.
Goot is the German word for good. So it does make sense.
Santa
goot. He's very goot. Well, last week I asked the question, who was the player from the smallest school on a CFL neg list? This week I decided to ask the question, who has been on a CFL neg list for the longest amount of time? I assumed that was going to be a quarterback, because the guys that teams are willing to be patient on typically are these QBs that they add when they're in their freshman or sophomore season, and they sit around hoping they'll fall to them. It was, in fact, not a quarterback, to my surprise, but the Calgary Stampeders, who have defensive end Pira Taumaupanu from Utah on their neg list. They've had him on there since May 28th, 2019, gentlemen. For a little bit of context, when he was added to the neg list, the number one movie in theaters was Avengers Endgame, and the number one song in the world was Old Town Road. So just to take you back to the mindset that the Calgary Stampeders were in, it was a dark time for the entire world. He was a sixth-round NFL draft pick with the San Francisco 49ers in 2017, only played about seven NFL games over 5 years, mostly because he's not very big, just 6'2", 240. But since then, he has had a tremendous career in alternative football leagues. He was the XFL Defensive Player of the Year in 2023. He was the UFL Defensive Player of the Year this past year in 2025 with 7.5 sacks. He is 31 years old, so on the older side, but Calgary is still hanging on, holding out hope that they can add a guy with some veteran presence and a little bit of twitch. It's not unprecedented for the Stampeders to add guys like this. Of course, we know PJ Walker was previously the longest tenured player on a CFL neg list, although he spent most of his neg list years with the Ottawa Redblacks. They added him shortly after moving him over to their neg list. They added Tommy Lee Lewis after waiting for him for over 7 years at the receiver position. And they've added a number of former NFL veterans who have been pushing 30 as well. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that you see Taumaupanu up here in the CFL in the future. And hopefully he can have a similar impact as what he had in the spring football leagues down south.
With all due respect, that's crazy. I just looked it up. This guy turns 32 in March. This guy's going to be a 32-year-old CFL rookie. Like, bro's got a mortgage and seven kids. That's a joke. I'm not saying he actually has seven kids. What? Like, really? That's crazy to me. So thank you for highlighting Mr. Taumaupanu. And by the way, JC, you did a terrible job of saying his name.
I was just butchered. I practiced so much last night. And then it came out like marbles. It was not great.
It came out well about the sixth try. The first five were bad, but you got it eventually. You got it eventually. Now time for Hodges' heritage moment. On this day in 1975, Edmonton trailed Calgary by a score of 29-2 with less than 1 minute remaining before halftime. Edmonton would go on to win the game 37-36, completing what was then the largest comeback in CFL history. This record was matched in 1994 when Winnipeg defeated Hamilton by a score of 46-44 after trailing 41-14 midway through the third quarter. My question, we'll start with Justin. If you were leading a game 41-14 midway through the third quarter and lost, how long would it take for you to no longer be mad about that?
Oh, man. I'd have to think about when I was in my 20s at Guelph drink. It would have taken a while. Probably the better part of a week.
I'll speak for myself. If I lost a game that I was leading 41-14 midway through the third quarter, I would never not be mad about it. I would be mad about it for the rest of my life. JC, how about you?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat there. That would be one of those ones where if someone brought it up years later, you're like, shut up, or we're gonna drop gloves here. It would not be good. It's on site if you're mentioning that loss.
I love it. Let's go to the 3-minute drill.
Hold up, CFL. Bro.
Okay, go ahead.
Katie quarterback.
We didn't plan for this.
Come on. That's mostly my fault. But I want to give a shout out to Alex Vreakin, Queen's University quarterback, who had an outstanding game against the upstart York University Lions over the weekend. Vreakin, 17-27, 394 yards and counting, 4 touchdowns with no interceptions in a decisive 57-5 win. His favorite target on the day, Nathan Falcone, caught 6 balls for 258 yards and 3 touchdowns. But I wanted to shout out Vreakin because we've talked about some of the other quarterbacks that have had big weeks over this past week in U Sports, namely Anton Amendrud had a big week for the Saskatchewan Huskies. Mm-hmm. He's really looked much better under the tutelage of Mason Nias, who of course himself was a star Huskies quarterback. But to me, Vreakin deserved a shout out. He's in his 5th year, goes about 6'4", 210 pounds, Kingston, Ontario native, getting it done in a big way. Now it's time for the 3-minute drill. U Sports has amended its transfer policy to allow first and second year players to change schools without penalty. Is this just going to mean all kinds of transfer action in Canadian university football?
I've heard really mixed things on this. Some people think this is a huge deal. Some people think it's no deal. I mean, the most impactful transfers are usually guys who go to the NCAA for a year and then come back, which I think has always been allowed, or at least has been for many years. So I'm kind of torn on this. I'm skeptical that it's going to change a lot, but you never know. Some of the biggest teams in U Sports could come poaching for the young talent on some of the lesser teams if guys pop off. CFL Commissioner Stuart Johnston told 620 CKRM's The Sports Cage he has received calls from both Canadian and international investors interested in owning an expansion franchise. Where is your dream expansion destination?
Well, I still think Halifax is the best place for CFL expansion. But if I have to get fantastical here, Hodge, there have been a lot of petitions and suggestions over the last number of years that Turks and Caicos should become the 11th Canadian province. I want to formally put in my application to be the beat reporter for the Cockburn Town Crabs. I think that would be an iconic CFL franchise. That is the capital of Turks and Caicos, by the way. I didn't just make that up. The Saskatchewan Roughriders have said they are working to make legal tailgating a reality at Mosaic Stadium next season. Will fans there soon be chilling and grilling?
I think it's possible, but I wouldn't be firing up your barbecues just yet, or you're going to run out of propane. There's still some steps to play out here, namely with the city of Regina. After a stunning upset over Montreal last week, the McGill Redbirds were run all over by Sherbrooke over the weekend. Is this the most chaotic RSEQ season that we can remember?
I mean, the RSEQ historically has been a two-team conference, and there's actually other teams we're talking about right now with some of these upsets that we're seeing. So yes, I do think that it is chaotic. And I mean, I think we're still going to get a Dunsmore or whatever it's called now between the Laval Rougeur and Montreal Caravan. But hey, we can have fun while we're getting there. McGill, unbelievable upset over the Caravan. But yeah, you got to beat the Varior. Like, come on. Come on. The BC Lions released former second-round NFL draft pick Kamoko Touré last week. Did that make sense?
It did. The Lions are getting much better pressure from the two guys that they brought in midseason, Levi Bell and Bradley Anae. And those guys, I think, have the potential to be impact players in the CFL for many years to come. It was a brilliant move by general manager Ryan Rigmaiden, and it made Touré expendable because his production just wasn't good enough. Cody Fajardo wants the CFL's new goalpost rule named after him because of his infamous crossbar doink in the 2019 West Final for Saskatchewan. Would you get behind that petition, Doug?
I would, although I'd like to ask Cody Fajardo if that's the legacy that he's like to have last in the CFL. He's got one great cup, so I'm sure he'd like to add to that, but it is interesting that he would like the rule or the change to be named after him. Former interim CFL commissioner Jim Lawson has been named vice chair of the Hamilton Tiger Cats ownership group. Is that an appropriate title?
I think so. I had a nice chat with Jim at Ted Gavai's funeral. He said he chats with Scott Mitchell every single day, and he seemed to kind of downplay this change. He's like, well, you know, I've been involved with the team for a long time, which I think is great. And obviously the Tie Cats are on an upswing, right? Certainly. So good for Jim. Congratulations on the new job, even if it's maybe a lot like his old, more unofficial job. 11th overall 2025 CFL draft pick Hayden Harris was at BC Place on Friday night at an invitation of the Lions. Does that mean he'll be signing with the team sometime soon?
I would peg it as probably sooner rather than later, but I've been told contract talks have not started between the two sides yet. Harris was with the Buffalo Bills at the start of training camp before being waived as injured, is still evaluating his NFL opportunities. He recently worked out with the Chicago Bears. If that doesn't arise, he could be an add for the playoffs. In addition to indigenized logos and orange warm-up jerseys, the CFL used orange laces on their kicking balls this week in support of National Truth and Reconciliation Day. Was that an appropriate gesture?
It was. I like how the CFL continues to add to this. And I think, you know, perhaps one tweak in the future is that they wear these orange jerseys in warm-ups. Perhaps there's a way to get more orange in the game. Like some people were saying, well, they wear them in warm-ups, but then not as many people are in the stadium to see them, or you don't see it on national TV. So I think anything that the CFL ads is great. And Hodge, before I toss the baton to you, I don't want to forget this because we want to make sure we're directing people to go sign up for the Three Down Nation daily newsletter. The easiest way to do it, go to threedownnation.com. On the right-hand side, pop your email in there, and you get all of the latest news on a daily basis right into your inbox. It's a growing list, but we really want to direct people there so that they get the latest and greatest from Three Down Nation directly sent to them. And we're going to add some bells and whistles along the way, fellas. So if you want to feel like an insider, you better get on that daily email newsletter.
Well, and how about Ben Major speaking Ojibwe at Prentice Auto Stadium? The audio is terrible in the press box in Winnipeg. You can't really tell what anybody on the field is saying. So my initial thought was like, is Ben announcing something in French? And then I caught it on the broadcast and it was like, oh, Ben is out here speaking Ojibwe, which I thought was amazing. What a talented person. Last but not least, we would like to recognize the passing of Edmonton Elks owner Larry Thompson at the age of 65, offer our condolences to his family members and friends. I think it is easy to say Larry will mostly be remembered for not only stepping in and putting a ton of money into the Elks at a time when they really needed it, but also the iconic shot of him driving that fire truck into the Calgary Stampeders bench, which honestly is one of the coolest things any sports owner has done in like 10 years. It's like, oh, our hated rivals in town, let's recklessly drive through their bench. That was an amazing image, and I loved seeing him get the tribute at a bunch of stadiums this week, obviously, but from TSN with that clip playing, that is one that will live in infamy. And again, our condolences to the Thompson family at this time.
That fire truck has to be involved in his funeral procession, if there is one at all. Like, it absolutely just has to be. There were shirts making the rounds. Morley Scott tweeted out a picture of a shirt that he was wearing while calling that game. I forget what the tagline underneath it was, but it was a shot of Larry Thompson on the Elks fire truck driving through the Calgary Stampeders sideline.
Well, and Larry's widow has said that they want to keep the team in the family, and that's wonderful. I know when Larry Thompson bought the team at his press conference, he said this is something he wants to have in his family. I believe he said this. This is a year ago now, so apologies if I'm misremembering, but this is something he wanted to have in his family for a long, long time. This was his childhood team, a team that he's loved for his entire life. So hopefully the Elks are in good hands still, despite Larry's passing. But for an ownership tenure that only lasted for the last year of Larry's life, it was certainly an impactful one. And Noah Curtis, I thought, had a brilliant story that he posted where Larry paid out of pocket. Noah Curtis, by the way, the defensive lineman for the Elks, where Larry paid out of pocket for his father's heart surgery. Noah Curtis's father needed surgery. Larry Thompson paid for it. That is amazing, and it's a testament to the owner that he was, and again, a short period of time. So we offer our condolences. For everybody else, we thank you, as always, for joining the Three Down Nation podcast, watching, listening. Be sure to rate, subscribe, all those things. For Justin Dunk, JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. Sign up for our newsletter. It'll make us happy. Yay!